The following presentation is brought to you from the supporters of the Church of the Sovereign God.
We will continue today in our overview of the Minor Prophets. We're close to the end. Today we're going to be looking into the book of Zechariah. If you take the Hebrew name or title, and I'll spell it for you, it's Z, or if you're from Canada, Z, Zekariah is the Hebrew spelling, and that word would literally mean Yah, which is J-A-H, which is God, it's the name of God. Yah has remembered. Or it could be rendered remembrance of Yah, or remembrance of the Lord, or remembrance of the Eternal, whichever word we would want to use there. And so it's God's remembering. That's really what it's talking about. There's really not a great deal known about the man, Zechariah's life, other than what we find in this particular book. He is mentioned in a couple of other books, but it's not really that we get a lot of information. Mainly what we have in his life is found in the book itself. Zechariah is the author of this prophetic book. However, having stated that, I would also need to point out that there are a growing number of modern scholars who are stating that they believe and they suggest that the book was written by at least two different writers. There's not sufficient evidence within the book or in other parts of the Bible where the book is referred to that would suggest that there's more than one author. And I mean, I could go into and tell you why they think that. It's unimportant as far as I'm concerned, but I do want you to know that the book was written around 520 to 480 BC. And yes, because there is a period of time that when it starts and when it ends, there is a lag time from part of it to the other part, which gives way to part of the reason why they suggest that there's at least two different writers, but there's not enough information to actually back that up. Chapters 1 through 8 are dated. In other words, we know when they're written because it gives enough information through Bible internal information and through secular history, we can date it. Chapters 9 through 14, which is the remainder of the book, they are undated. The book tells us that chapter 1, verses 1 through 6, occurs during the month of Chesvan, and we know that happens to be the eighth month, and we also happen to know that that occurred in about 520 BC, the eighth month of the second year of Darius, or Darius, however you would want to pronounce his name. And he reigned from 521 to 486 BC. Again, dates put in pencil. But I do believe these dates are pretty accurate. The prophecies of chapter 1, verse 7, all the way through chapter 6, verse 15, all occurred on the same date of the month. They all occurred on the 24th day of the 11th month, Shevet, and that occurred in 520 BC. Now, we are currently in this particular month, the month of Shevet, and so it's pertinent to us in this time, meet and due season, I guess you could stretch the term and say that. So the book has a lot of information for us in the time in which we find ourselves. Many of the prophecies, or as they are referred to in different places within the book as visions or oracles, and I know the word oracle simply would mean to us as sayings. Well, we could refer to them either as prophecies, visions, or oracles, or even using the word burdens, and they're all the same. Now, I'm going to use the word prophecies. Many of the prophecies are ultimately about the Church of God in the last days. And hopefully by the end of the sermon, we'll be able to see a lot of that and come to that conclusion on your own as well. Now, we're looking at this as an overview. There is no way that in the one sermon that I'm going to be able to go into great detail and read a lot of the verses. We are going to read verses, but I'm going to give you a broad overview with the encouragement in mind that if you've not read it recently or have never read it, read the book. Especially once you have this as an overview that you're going to see today, read it again with this in mind. And I'm telling you, I believe the book will come more alive to you because there'll be a lot more information and you'll go, oh, I see what he's talking about. Because sometimes we read these prophetic books and we go, yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, that's interesting. And they are. But when you have more to attach to it, the why it's written, the where it's written, and why it's written at the time that it is, then it means a lot more. And so I'm going to encourage you to reread the book if you never have once you've got this background. Chapter 7 and 8 were written during the month of Kislev, which is the ninth month. In fact, it tells us that it was the fourth day of the ninth month of Darius, the fourth year, which would be 518 BC. As I said, there's a lot of information that is dated chapters 1 through 8, chapters 9 through 14, no dates. Chapters 9 through 14 are undated, but probably occurred around 480 BC. And there's reasons for us to believe that's probably a pretty good date because it occurred, we know this writing occurred after Greece became the world leader following their overthrow of Darius I, which occurred in 490 BC, and the overthrow of Artaxerxes in about 480 BC. Now, I know this is going to sound like a lot of history and all of that. We'll get into the book and see some things that are much more important, but I think it still gives us more of an overview as to where it's happening. I think it's very helpful to do this. The theme overall has two major prongs, two major forks, two major points. The first one is the command to rebuild the temple. I mean, Zechariah is in there telling the Jews to get in there and build the temple. That's why we were sent back here, and that's why we were allowed after 70 years of captivity, that we can come out, that we can come here, and we can build the temple again. And so the first command was to rebuild the temple. The second one is descriptions of the first and second coming of the Messiah. There's an interesting point for us to notice, and that is that Zechariah was both a prophet and a priest. His father's name means the eternal blesses. And his grandfather, whose name was Iddo, it's I-D-D-O, and actually it would be pronounced more Iddo. His name means the appointed times. They both were also priests. Iddo was one of the leading priests to return from the exile in about 536 B.C. under Zerubbabel and Joshua, who was the high priest. You can go to the book of Nehemiah or Nehemiah 12, verse 1. And we're going to read portions of three different verses. We're going to read portions of verse 1, verse 4, and verse 16. Verse 1 says, now these are the priests and the Levites that went out with Zerubbabel. And then it lists some of them. And then you come down to verse 4, the list continues on. And in verse 4, it says Iddo or Iddo. And then in verse 16, it says of Iddo, Zechariah. Zechariah is named as a prophet and the son of Iddo in Ezra chapter 5 and verse 1 and chapter 6 verse 14. What we need to understand, see, there's not a conflict because what we need to understand is it is not unusual in Scripture to list the grandfather as father if the father is either dead or the grandfather is considered to be of a really important person or really important figure within whatever the story is that's being told. And so when it says Iddo is the father of, he's the grandfather of, because in the book of Zechariah, he tells us who his father is and who his grandfather is. And so we know this, but like I said, that's an interesting thing. Zechariah is the only minor prophet who was also a priest. He is the last known Old Testament prophet to be martyred. And he was killed by the Jews, as it says, between the altar and the temple. Go with me to Matthew chapter 23 and verse 35. Jesus Christ is telling us this. Matthew 23 verse 35. That upon you may come all the righteous blood shed upon the earth, from the blood of righteous Abel unto the blood of Zacharias. That's him. The son of, it's pronounced Barakas, or there's several different ways in which we pronounce it. I'm going to pronounce it Barakas, whom you slew between the temple and the altar. So Zechariah is named by Jesus Christ as being the son of. And also, if you follow what I'm saying here, and it shows that he was killed. And he is the last known prophet of the Old Testament to be martyred. Jewish tradition states that the last three prophets, meaning the last three prophets of the 12, the minor prophets, and that would be Zechariah, Haggai, and Malachi, founded what became known as the Great Synagogue, which was the forerunner of the Sanhedrin. Now, there also is enough evidence to suggest, at least, that Ezra created this school that became known as the Great Synagogue, which became later known as the Sanhedrin. So this was something that was started around that time, but the credit is given to these last three of the 12 minor prophets as being the ones who founded it and who started it and kept it running. And then, of course, in the time of Jesus Christ, it had already become hundreds of years before known as the Sanhedrin. We know that Zechariah's ministry took place during the reign of Darius the Great. Go with me to chapter 1 and verse 1. This is Zechariah, chapter 1 and verse 1. In the eighth month, in the second year of Darius, came the word of the Lord unto Zechariah, the son of Barakas, the son of Iddo, the prophet, saying. And so he names him, and we know when it took place, because it says within it, naming the dates. He was contemporary with Haggai as well as Malachi, even though he doesn't have as much contact, I'm going to say, with Malachi. They're not named together so much, but there were a lot of overlap in their datings. And he is contemporary more with Haggai in a post-exile world after the fall of Jerusalem in 587-586 B.C. In other words, Jerusalem fell. There was a captivity. They're brought out, and he is more part of this after they had been brought back out. This is where he is and Haggai. This is the time they are. Zechariah and Jeremiah. You're going to go, whoa, this is so getting into so many details. Well, it's all going to make sense whenever we get it together. You'll see this. But the prophet Zechariah and Jeremiah wrote prior to the fall of Jerusalem while continuing to prophesy on into the early exile period. I mean, they were prophets for a long, long time. This is the point I'm making. Now, here's the reason why I'm telling you this and why this is an interesting point to know. It's because there are many scholars, and I would tend to agree when you look at the one book and you look into Zechariah, I think that they may be correct, that there are many prophets who believe that Ezekiel, because of his combining of ceremony and vision together, heavily influenced the prophetic work of Zechariah, especially chapters 1 through 8. And I would agree that whether he knew him, I don't know, but at least he, having been a priest and having been connected with the temple, would have had access to records at least. And so I do think that he was influenced in the way he wrote some of his things from Ezekiel. I do believe that. During that period of time of the exile, many of the Jews were taken, obviously, to Babylon, and they were told by the prophets to make their homes there. You can see that in Jeremiah chapter 29, suggesting that they would be there for a long period of time. Zechariah tells us they were there 70 years. I mean, he says it. And so we understand it from history. It says, he says it in the book, 70 years. And so we know how long the period of time lasts. And so eventually, freedom did come to many of the Israelites when Cyrus the Great overtook the Babylonians in 539 BC. Then in 538, this is the next year, 538 BC, the famous Edict of Cyrus was released and was put out there, and the first return of the exiles took place under this particular leader that he appointed to go there. And then after the death of Cyrus in 530, Darius control takes over as the ruling. He took office. And he did something that was very interesting. He divided the colonies, back in the land of Judah. They had settled into different colonies. Well, he comes in and he puts them into what would be called different districts. And then he put governors over these different districts so that he could manage them a lot simpler by doing it in that way. Zerubbabel, which you all know, you've heard his name, comes into the story when Darius appointed him governor over the district that became known as the province of Judah, which would be in the area of where Jerusalem is. And this is where his story comes. I mean, this is where he comes in. He was sent back there to be one of the governors. And that's how a lot of this took place. And so sometimes we have these names, but we don't know how it happened. This is what has happened. Meaning there were other governors in other provinces or other districts, and there's not a lot of information about them. This one is important because of where he was, who he was, what is symbolic of in prophecy, and all of that. Also, during the reign of Darius or Darius, Zechariah became also known, and of course he centered most of his attention upon the rebuilding of the temple. Now, I also told you there was a two-pronged purpose, and the second purpose was giving descriptions of the first and second coming of Messiah. Another interesting point for us to understand, it helps us to understand this book and other books as well, especially in the Old Testament. Unlike the Babylonians, the Persian Empire went to great length to make workable relationships with those people that they placed in the land with those who were the lords over them, the rulers over them. We may want to call them the vassals and lords. That's a term that is known in history in various places. It would come into play here. The rebuilding of the temple was encouraged by the leaders of the Persian Empire in hopes that it would strengthen the relationship and the authorities with the local leaders back to the Persian Empire. And so they did this for a lot of different reasons. And as a result, it became what I would call, and I think we'd understand it this way, good politics on the part of the Persians. And all the time, the Jews referred to it as a blessing from God. So I think as much as anything, it was a blessing from God, and God used the Persians to do it in the way, and he did it through politics. But it was a blessing from God. And so you have to understand how the Persians really played a great deal in this because God is directing them. And it's a good thing to see. Okay, now with that in mind, I'd like for us to look into the context of the book itself. And first we're going to look at chapters 1 through 6. Like I said, we're not going to be reading a great deal of the of the passages in there. More even here, I'm going to tell you what's in a lot of these different sections. And so we're going to, first of all, we're going to look at chapters 1 through 6, and we're going to look at these pretty much together. And it begins in chapter 1, verse 1 through 6, which would be considered as a preface. He's setting it up. And so he goes through in the eighth month, and then in the second year of Darius the king, the word of the Lord came to him. Verse 2, the Lord has been sore displeased with your fathers. Therefore, say you unto them, thus saith the Lord of hosts, turn you unto me, saith the Lord of hosts, and I will turn unto you, says the Lord of hosts. This phrase, the Lord of hosts, or any of a variation of that, that phrase is interesting because it occurs 42 different times in this book. There's a purpose for that, and if I can get into that, I'll give you a little more reason for that a little bit later. Verse 4. Be you not as your fathers, unto whom the former prophets have cried, saying, thus saith the Lord of hosts, turn you now from your evil ways and from your evil doings, but they did not hear, nor hearkened unto me, says the Lord. But your fathers, where are they? And the prophets, do they live forever? A lot of this is the words from God who inspired him being Zechariah, to write these words down. We know that from the New Testament. It says, where did the scriptures come from? It says, holy men of God were moved along by the Spirit of God to write, meaning as the Lord and the Spirit had moved them along, encouraged them to write it down. So we know this comes from God. So he's writing it down. Verse 6, but my words and my statutes, which I commanded my servants the prophets, they did not take hold of your fathers. And they returned and said, like as the Lord of hosts thought to do unto us according to our ways and according to our doings, so does he deal with us. And so what he's saying is, how are you going to now deal with God? Your fathers, hey, they went into captivity. This is what he's saying. We know what happened to them. They were told they didn't listen to the prophets. And here Zechariah is saying, here I am a prophet. Haggai is out there. You've got Ezekiel and you've got Jeremiah on the scene as well. And all these prophets, and they didn't listen. What are you going to do? This is sort of what they're saying. I mean, this is somewhat, in essence, what he's telling them. What are you going to do now that you have this opportunity? What are you going to do? What he was doing was he was retelling or recalling the nation's history with the purpose in mind of presenting a warning, a very solemn, sober warning to the generation that he was at that point addressing and writing to. Like I said earlier, it's twofold, because many of these prophecies in this book were also written in mind to the church of God in the latter days. And so as you go through and you read these prophecies, yeah, he's talking to these people at that time, but he is also in a spiritual sense talking to the church of God today. And so we need to read it and think about it in that mind. Then in chapters 1, verse 7 through 6, verse 8, there's this series of eight visions or prophecies. These visions came one after the other, all in one night, which was the 24th of the month of Shavuot. And we already stated we're in that month right now. I think this can be considered as a symbolic history of Israel intending to give comfort to those who had returned, who had returned from the exile. And it was also to stir up hope in their mind and in their thinking that, you know, he's already warned them, and then he said, now what are we going to do about it? You know, it was to stir them up. This symbolic action, like one of the things that take place was the crowning of Joshua, describes how the kingdoms of the world become the kingdoms of God's Messiah. I mean, we see that, and this is one of those prophecies. Let's go there. Zechariah chapter 6 and verse 9. And it's somewhat awkward in the reading, but it's symbolic. You have to see it as being symbolic, you know, of something here. Verse 9, and the word of the Lord came to me, saying, take of them of the captivity, even of Hildai, and then he goes through all of these names, Tobojai and Zabiah, which are come from Babylon, and come you the same day, and go into the house of Josiah, the son of Zephaniah. It's not the prophet Zephaniah, this is another Zephaniah. And he says, then take silver and gold and make crowns and set up on the head of Joshua, the high priest, and speak unto him, saying, thus saith the Lord of hosts, saying, behold, the man whose name is the branch. So you see, this is all symbolic. Joshua is high priest, but he's symbolic of somebody. He's symbolic of the branch. And so who is the branch? It's referring to Jesus Christ. And this book lets us know this. And so this is more of what is to be future done than what is actually happening right then at the time whenever he's writing and they're living this. And he shall grow up out of his place, and he shall build the temple of the Lord. Now, who is the he will grow up and will build the temple? Is he talking about Joshua the high priest, or is he talking about the branch? And the answer is yes, because he's speaking about two different temples. One is talking about the temple building, and the other one is talking about the temple, the church. Verse 13, and he shall build the temple of the Lord, and he shall bear the glory, and shall sit and rule upon his throne, and he shall be a priest upon his throne, and the council of peace shall be between them both. Joshua was a priest. He didn't sit on a throne. But he was going to be the high priest of the temple, and so he was involved in it. And this is what he's saying. But it's referring to Jesus, verse 14. And the crowns shall be to Helam and to Tobiah and to Zedaiah and to Hen, the son of Zephaniah, for a memorial in the temple of the Lord. And they that are far off shall come and build in the temple of the Lord, and you shall know that the Lord of hosts has sent me unto you. And this shall come to pass, if you will diligently obey the voice of the Lord your God. This is going to happen if you diligently obey the voice of the Lord. So, yeah, he's encouraging the people there to get in and let's rebuild and let's get it going and build the temple, which is symbolic of a future building of a temple, which is the church of God. Chapters 9 through 14. This section consists of two oracles or two burdens, as it is worded in different translations. The first burden, which is chapters 9 through 11, gives an outline of the way of God's destined dealings with his people down to the coming of the Messiah. In other words, how he's going to deal with them in the future. He's not necessarily describing how he's going to deal with the people then and there. It's more futuristic. And that's why sometimes people read these books and it goes, this is confusing. Yeah, it is, whenever you don't see what he's actually, how he, the prophet, is actually dealing with. They could be dealing with then and there, but they also could be interspersing things that are not necessarily for then and there. It's prophetic to what is symbolic of later. And this is what he's doing here. The second burden, which is chapters 12 through 14, points out the glories that await Israel in the latter day, when the final conflict and triumph of God's kingdom is realized. And that's what he talks about. The purpose of this book is not strictly historical, even though there's a lot of historical information, but that's not the main focus. The main point is not strictly historical, but is probably more so theological and pastoral. So we can understand more about God, and that as, quote, ministers, prophets, priests, whatever term would be used, would have information that could be passed on to the people. I think maybe that's another reason why I'm looking at it and saying, We have to see it from this, you know, have, you know, people explaining it so that we can understand why he's writing the way he's writing and what he's saying by what he is saying. Is it for then or is it for later? And the answer could be yes. It could be for both or either one. The main emphasis is that the Lord is at work and he plans to live among his people again in Jerusalem. So this is a prophecy of the second coming of Messiah. I told you earlier that he focuses on descriptions of the first and second coming of Messiah. And this is one more about when it's going to be futuristic second coming. And it's during these particular passages that shows that the Messiah will save them from their enemies and will cleanse them from their sins. Jesus didn't do that when he came the first time. And he didn't do that during the time of when they were rebuilding the temple. So again, we know that it is even yet futuristic. The prophecies are future. Zechariah's concern for the purity is evident in how he's dealing with the temple, how he's dealing with the priesthood, and how he's also dealing with all other areas of life of the people. One of the main reasons that we can see that is because of the prophecy, how gradually eliminates the influence of the governor, which is a political appointee, in favor of the high priest. And also we can see it more from the fact that the sanctuary becomes even more clearly the center of messianic fulfillment, a reference to the church. So he's concerned about cleansing, purity, and he's talking about from the temple. Yeah, they were going to build the temple and it needed to be clean, but he's also, that's prophetic of the future temple, i.e. the church. And he's also talking about the cleansing of the priesthood, which you could also be referring to the priesthood then, as well as also the, quote, ministry / priesthood in the future, as well as all these other areas that need to be cleaned up. It's for then and future that he's dealing with in so many of these different passages. Prophecy is apparent, is evidently there in Zechariah, but it is also true that Zechariah, along with Haggai, allows prophecy to give way to the priesthood. That becomes even more important within his writing, even though this is a prophetic book. It starts giving way from the prophecies and going more to the priesthood and how they're going to use it or teach it or whatever. And so it's pretty evident. Most commentaries state that the series of prophecies that are found between chapters 7 through 14 are messianic in nature, whether it be either directly or indirectly. But most commentaries will recognize those prophecies. They are messianic in nature, directly or indirectly. Brethren, I think when it's rightly understood, these chapters, meaning 7 through 14 that I just was mentioning, I believe that these chapters were used heavily by the four gospel writers to help them understand what Jesus Christ went through. I think that to help them to understand Jesus' suffering, his death, and his resurrection, because they quote from Zechariah numerous times during the last final days of Jesus' life on the earth, and then afterwards. I didn't look it up, and I didn't count it, the number of references in the New Testament to the book of Zechariah, but there are dozens. In fact, much of the book of Revelation also includes some of the images that are found in the book of Zechariah. And that's not something I think most of us would even consider or even think about, but it's definitely there. Chapters 9 through 14 of Zechariah is an early example of what would be referred to as apocalyptic literature. In other words, shall we say doomsday, as some people may want to refer to it. Even though they are not as fully developed as some of the apocalyptic visions that are described in the book of Daniel, these sayings, these prophecies, these oracles, as they are found here in Zechariah chapters 9 through 14, they do contain this type of information. They do contain a great deal of that kind of futuristic doomsday type information. One of those themes that are found in these oracles is a description of the day of the Lord. Let's go to Zechariah chapter 14 and verse 3. Zechariah 14 verse 3. Then shall the Lord go forth and fight against those nations when he fought in the day of battle. Now, when did the Lord fight in the day of battle? Well, it's a reference back to bringing the children of Israel out of Egypt. I mean, that's what he's referring to. And he says, like he fought for the children of Israel back then, in the end days, he's going to fight for his people again. This is what he's saying. So this is a day of the Lord type reference that he's referring to. Okay. Now what I'd like to give to you is what I consider to be some of the key verses in the book. Again, I recommend you read all of it because it's all important. But I want to point out some particular passages or a verse here and there so you can see it and see these as being really key verses. One is Zechariah chapter 1 and verse 3. Therefore saying you unto them, thus saith the Lord of hosts, turn you unto me, saith the Lord of hosts, and I will turn unto you, saith the Lord of hosts. If you turn to me, I'm going to turn to you. God says so. That's important. Another one is in chapter 7 and verse 13. Therefore it has come to pass that as he cried, and they would not hear, so they cried, and I would not hear, saith the Lord of hosts. So in the beginning he says, remember what our forefathers did. They went up in captivity, and so if you cry to the God, he's gonna hear us. And God says, I will hear you. And here he says, because you didn't listen, I'm not listening to you. Chapter 9 and verse 9. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. And what is Zion a reference of? Yes, it could be a reference of the area in the Jerusalem area. It could be a reference to the city of Jerusalem. And more, I believe, in prophecy, it is a reference to the church. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, daughter of Jerusalem. See, your king comes to you, righteous and having salvation, gentle and riding on a donkey, of a coat, the foal of a donkey. How did Jesus Christ enter into Jerusalem, his final trip? Riding on a donkey. That's so symbolic. It is so symbolic. And here is the prophecy that it comes from. It says it's going to happen. And then it happens. But there's so much reason for it happening, and I'm not going to really get into that right here. I have another verse, and that's in chapter 13 and verse 9. These are some of the key passages. 13 verse 9, and I will bring the third part through the fire, and will refine them as silver is refined, and will try them as gold is tried. They shall call on my name, and I will hear them. I will say, it is my people, and they shall say, the Lord is my God. This is more to the end of the book, and it's more obviously referring to future end of the age, the church. The last verse in the book of Zechariah, we find a very interesting statement. There's a couple of different things here, but there's one very important, I think. So go with me to Zechariah 14 in verse 21. It's the last verse in the book. Yea, every pot in Jerusalem and in Judah shall be holiness unto the Lord of hosts. And all they that sacrifice shall come and take of them and seethe therein. And in that day there shall be no more the Canaanite in the house of the Lord of hosts. So this is all futuristic because this didn't happen back then. This didn't happen back then. So this is all futuristic. So the book ends with a prophetic messianic statement about what God, Jesus Christ in particular, is going to do. And it says, in that day, in every pot in Jerusalem and in Judah shall be holiness. And all they that sacrifice shall come and take of them. Them are those, quote, holy, clean pots that all the people are going to have. Now, are the people in Jerusalem in that last day going to be holy? No, this is referring to, again, to the church. They're going to be coming and taking from the church what the church is going to have, because they're going to be changed at that particular time. And so this is all during that particular time what he's referring to. But the point I want to do, and it says, and in that day there shall be no more the Canaanite in the house of the Lord of hosts. Zechariah is proclaiming the need of purity in the temple, as well as he is proclaiming the need of the coming of the temple, the rebuilding it back then. And of course, the future arrival or coming of the temple is a reference to, again, it's the church of God. And it's going to come when the Messiah returns and brings judgment. Now, with all this in mind, I want you to go with me now to Isaiah 52 and verse 1. I'm going to read this from the New International Version. Isaiah 52 and verse 1. Awake, awake, O Zion, church. Clothe yourself with strength. Put on your garments of splendor, O Jerusalem, the holy city, the uncircumcised, some translations say the unholy, and defiled, will not enter you again. It's a warning. It's to the church. A time is coming when the church is going to be cleansed. We've seen in our days, in our lifetime, how the church, I believe, has been cleansed or starting to be cleansed on several different occasions. And it's going to continue to be cleansed until every pot is clean and there is no Canaanite represented as an unclean, uncircumcised, or defiled person will not enter you again. It's not going to be there. I think this book is so heavily prophetic to what they were going to do then, what they needed to do then, and they did build the temple. They eventually did build the temple as they were prophesied and they were told to do. But it is prophetic, looking forward to the time of the return of Jesus Christ, and ultimately it's referring to the church of God. So again, I would recommend that you go back, if you've never read the book with this information in mind now, or if you've not read the book in a long time, go back and reread it with this. Look for the prophetic statements that are in this, I believe, an absolutely fascinating, incredible book that focuses so much information on the church of God. Okay, like I said, that's about a third of the notes that I've taken in my studying, pulling all of this together. I'm not kidding you. But anyway, we're going to end it there because it is so much more there. Okay, and now the Aaronic blessing. I hope you feel so blessed to know, to be part of what God is doing and knowing these things. The Aaronic blessing. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious unto you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. God bless you all. God's name is upon you, and all of this is available to each one of us. Happy Sabbath, and God bless you all.
For more information or answers to your Bible questions, please contact the Church of the Sovereign God. Our website is www.cotsg.org. That's www.cotsg.org. Or you may write to us at Post Office Box 89111. That's Post Office Box 89111, Tampa, Florida 33689.